Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
In 2012, a new charity bursts onto the scene. It's called Believe in Magic and it grants wishes to seriously ill children. It has the support of the biggest boy band in the world. One Direction. It's run by an inspirational 16-year-old girl called Megan Bari, who herself is battling a brain tumour.
I've been in and out of hospital and seen so many other very poorly children.
But when questions arise about her story, they reveal she could be facing another very different danger.
What is this girl going through?
It wasn't supposed to end like this.
Listen to Believe in Magic with me, Jamie Bartlett.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 14th of May, these are our main stories. A ceasefire between Israel and Islamic Jihad militants in the Gaza Strip appears to be holding despite reports of minor breaches. President Zelensky of Ukraine has met Pope Francis at the Vatican after Italy's leaders assured him of their full support. One of Sudan's most prominent singers has been killed in crossfire as clashes continue between the army and a rival military faction. Also in this podcast, how a Cambodian runner won people's hearts despite finishing last in a race.
I tried to reach the finish line because I wanted to show people that in life we should not give up, we should try our best.
After a shaky start, a ceasefire has come into effect between Israel and Palestinian militants of the Islamic Jihad group in Gaza. It was brokered by Egypt after 5 days of firing between the two sides that has seen at least 33 Palestinians killed in Gaza and two people killed in Israel, one of them a Gazan who was working there. Despite more firing just before and after the ceasefire began, there are hopes it will hold. Our reporter in Gaza, Rushdie Abu Alouf, gave us this update.
For the last 15 or 20 minutes, we haven't seen any Israeli rocket. Last Palestinian rocket was at 10:17 minutes after the ceasefire went into effect, followed by an Israeli airstrike in one of the Islamic Jihad militants group military compound in the south. No one was injured. Since then, it's holding. It's a sense of like a mood of celebration in the street. As I'm talking, I'm looking over the balcony on the main streets. Hundreds of people driving their cars, celebrating the ceasefire. Those people have been trapped in their house for 5 days since the beginning of the fighting. Schools were off. Nobody was going to the work. Most of the shops were closed. So it's a sense of relief for the people after this. The fighting has been intensified the last day with Israeli airstrikes targeted about 14 houses belong to Islamic Jihad militants. They destroyed a lot of houses. Islamic Jihad also was intensifying the rocket attack into Israel. We have seen as much as 200 rockets today, according to sources in Islamic Jihad. Egypt was doing a lot of push for both sides to accept the final draft that they sent. It's the third draft in the last 48 hours. The first one was rejected by Israel, according to Egyptian sources. Second one was rejected by Islamic Jihad. And then finally, the agreement came today. Islamic Jihad was demanding that Israel should commit not to kill more Islamic Jihad leaders and to stop targeting the houses. And according to the senior commander in Islamic Jihad, actually the one who was leading the discussion with the Egyptian, he told me this evening that they have achieved what they were like demanding. That's why they accepted the ceasefire.
Rushdie Abu Alouf. On Saturday, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky paid his first visit to Italy since Russia invaded Ukraine last year. He was there for talks with political leaders and later Pope Francis. He said it was an important visit for approaching victory in Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky was greeted on his arrival with full military honours. Italy's Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, assured Mr. Zelensky that he had the full support of her country.
Oggi ancora una volta è un messaggio chiaro.
The message we want to reiterate once again is a clear and simple one. The future of Ukraine is a future of peace and freedom, and it's European, and there's no other possible solution. I'm convinced that Ukraine will win, and that it will be reborn stronger, prouder, and more prosperous than before.
At the same time as Mr. Zelensky was meeting Italy's leaders, Germany announced a $3 billion military aid package for Ukraine, its biggest since the start of Russia's invasion last year, leading to speculation the Ukrainian leader may go on to visit Berlin. This show of European support comes at a potentially pivotal moment in the war, with Ukrainian troops making advances near the hotly contested eastern city of Bakhmut ahead of a widely anticipated counter-offensive against Russia's forces. Our correspondent in Rome, Sofia Bitizza, told us more about Mr. Zelensky's visit to Italy.
This is the first time that President Zelensky visits Italy since Russia invaded Ukraine last year. He has been here since 10 a.m. in the morning, and there's been about over 1,000 security officers deployed here in Rome. He had a meeting with his counterpart, Italian President Sergio Mattarella, and he said that he wants to thank Italy. He'd like to hug each Italian one by one for the support that they've offered to Ukraine. He then went on to meet Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. They had a working lunch. And, you know, both leaders, Mattarella and Meloni, as you mentioned earlier, reiterated Italy's full support for Ukraine in terms of military, financial, humanitarian aid in the short and the long term.
And this visit comes despite the fact that there are strong ties between Moscow and Rome historically, including within Ms. Meloni's hard right coalition.
You're absolutely right. Italy is a country that has historically, as you said, had strong ties with Moscow. You know, since the Ukraine invasion, Italy has actually become a haven for pro-Kremlin disinformation and propaganda. Italy's Parliamentary Committee for Security even launched an inquiry into Kremlin disinformation. And then, of course, you've got Silvio Berlusconi, whose political party is in the governing coalition. He's an old friend of Vladimir Putin. They went on holiday together. They gave each other presents for their birthdays. And Berlusconi even said a few weeks ago that he would not want to meet President Zelensky because he blames him for Russia's war with Ukraine. So, you know, given all of this, today was quite a delicate balancing act, you know, diplomatically for Giorgia Meloni, the prime minister.
And Mr. Zelensky also met Pope Francis.
That's right. They had a private audience in the Vatican. They met for about 40 minutes. And, you know, this is significant because it's the first time that President Zelensky meets the head of the Catholic Church since Russia invaded Ukraine. They both agreed on the need to continue humanitarian efforts to help the victims of the conflict. And Pope Francis also told Mr. Zelensky that he constantly prays for peace in Ukraine. Now, of course, the Pope cannot enforce peace. He's not a political leader, but he can be a very influential figure. He could facilitate dialogue between political leaders that don't really see eye to eye. And, you know, throughout history, several popes have done that. For example, Pope John Paul II has had a vital role before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So, you know, a very symbolic meeting today between the two leaders.
Sofia Bitizza. One of Sudan's leading singers, Shardan Gardoud, has been killed in crossfire just outside the capital, Khartoum, in the twin city of Omdurman. A month after fighting erupted between the army and a rival military faction, and despite repeated ceasefires, fierce clashes have been continuing in the capital and other cities. Hundreds have died and more than 500,000 people have been displaced since the start of the war. Camilla Mills reports.
Shardan Gardoud often sang for peace and security in her region. She made live videos on Facebook talking about the clashes between the Sudanese army and the RSF paramilitaries, including one where she said she was trying to hide from the shelling and asked her son to close the windows. Fighting has been ongoing for almost 4 weeks. Her death comes only a day after the warring parties signed a deal to try and put an end to civilian suffering and ahead of new ceasefire talks on Sunday.
Camilla Mills. Hundreds of thousands of people have been evacuated from their homes in Bangladesh and Myanmar as they brace for Cyclone Mocha to make landfall on Sunday. But not everyone has been able to seek shelter. On the Bangladeshi side of the border, the coastal region of Cox's Bazar is home to the world's largest refugee camp, housing Rohingya Muslims who fled persecution in Myanmar. Their flimsy makeshift housing makes them particularly vulnerable to the coming storm.
As much as I can, I'll try to keep my children safe with all I have. There's no tarpaulin, there's no rope. If the storm takes everything away, we will try to collect it again.
The BBC's Rajini Vaidyanathan is in Cox's Bazar and she spoke to my colleague Rebecca Kesby.
I can see the clouds look menacing. Rain has started to fall. It's Saturday evening here, and of course landfall is not predicted till Sunday lunchtime. But a vast evacuation operation is already underway. Even since Friday, there have been fire engines going around with tannoy announcements telling people to take shelter, particularly people who live in low-lying coastal areas here. And we've just come from a school that's been turned into a cyclone shelter, and we saw dozens and dozens of families, many women carrying their young babies in their arms, going and taking shelter in school classrooms. Some people had brought their livestock with them, cattle and chickens as well. But there are a lot of other people, and I'm just looking down on the street below me, who aren't really taking heed of those warnings and seem to be getting on with their everyday lives.
Well, of course, it's quite an undertaking, isn't it, to move so many people. What can you tell us about how they're managing it with the refugee camps in particular?
Well, Bangladesh is no stranger to cyclones, and this is the time of year when cyclone-sized season begins. But what forecasters are saying about this particular cyclone, Cyclone Mocha, is that it could be one of the worst they've seen in well over a decade. Of course, we won't really know until it makes landfall, but that is why a lot of people here are on edge. But you mentioned the Rohingya refugee camps that are about an hour to an hour and a half away from where I am. Now, the issue with those is that the refugees living in those camps are not allowed to go to one of these government shelters like the one I visited to, because they're not allowed to leave the refugee camps. And therefore, they feel incredibly terrified because the shelters that they live in are very flimsy. We were there only a few days ago. The shelters that are made for them are small, they're made of bamboo, they have tarpaulin roofs. They're very unlikely to survive a very fierce storm, which could be the case. And then, of course, there's the aftermath of the storm as well, which could be flash flooding and landslides, which could really impact the refugee camp. Now, I spoke to somebody from the Bangladeshi authorities, someone who's involved in kind of running the refugee camps here, and he said they're not going to be able to move people. And one of the reasons is because there's so many people, close to a million Rohingya refugees live in those camps. So he said it's just not practical.
Rajini Vaidyanathan. Well, while people are bracing for a cyclone along the Bay of Bengal, residents of a tiny village in the Swiss Alps are leaving their homes after being ordered to evacuate because of the risk of rock slides. Climate change is making such events more common, raising questions about the safety of some mountain communities. Imogen Folks sent this report.
In Brienz, villagers have become used to the sound of boulders rolling down the hill, landing sometimes even in their gardens. But geologist Samuel Loewe, who's been studying the mountainside, warns those isolated rockfalls could become something much bigger.
Above the village, we have quite a steep slope, and one sector, which is about 2 million cubic meter in volume, we observe a very special type of acceleration of the velocity, let's say, for the last 6 months. This could lead to, in the worst case, to something which we call a rock avalanche, which can have speeds of 100 to 200 kilometers per hour.
Dass dieser Entscheid gefällt werden muss und die Evakuierung.
Local authorities had already warned the villagers an evacuation might be necessary sometime in late summer. But days of heavy rain and much more forecast caused a sudden change. Rient's mayor, Daniel Albertine, told his community on Tuesday they must leave by Friday.
It's gone very quickly. The rock is moving much faster than we'd hoped. Taking the step to order the evacuation is hard. There'll be some emotion, that's clear.
And so the rush to pack. Most villagers have found places to stay nearby, but it's still a shock. It's difficult. We don't know how long it will be, so we don't know what to take, says one woman. It's happened so fast. I'm not even sure where I'm going yet. I've got all my paperwork, says an elderly lady standing on her doorstep with her suitcase, but I'm going to wait until the last minute. The fate of Brienz has gripped Switzerland all week. In part, says geologist Simon Loewe, because global warming is causing changes that mean living in the Alps is becoming riskier.
In high alpine areas, some parts of the permafrost are permanently melting. And of course, this induces instabilities. These instabilities affect cable cars, alpine huts. We also expect at lower elevation, due mainly to the intensity of rain, a higher occurrence of rockfall events, of what we call a shallow, rapid, instantaneous landslides.
Geologist Simon Loewe ending that report from Imogen Folks in Switzerland. Still to come.
Several years ago, somebody selling 1,000 pills, that was a big deal. Now we're seeing people are selling millions of pills a month.
We report on efforts to fight back against the devastation caused by the drug fentanyl in the United States. We'll be back right after this.
We live in a time of information overload.
A flurry of disinformation.
Where things are not always what they seem.
Fake. It is fake news.
The Global Jigsaw is the new podcast from BBC Monitoring, shining a light on the conflicting agendas and narratives being played out in the world's media.
Narratives that slowly permeate the citizenry.
Where powerful interests are competing to influence your views. Search for The Global Jigsaw wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. There's been a significant election win for India's main opposition Congress Party in the southern state of Karnataka on Saturday. According to the Election Commission's website, Congress has won more than 130 out of 224 state assembly seats. It only needed a majority of 113 to form a state government, so it's a convincing win. But what does it tell us about the position of the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, and his governing Hindu Nationalist Party, the BJP? Ahead of nationwide elections next year. Rebecca Kesby has been speaking to the Indian political journalist Sabha Naqvi. How much of a surprise was this result?
The fact that the Congress won is not a surprise, but the scale of the victory is surprising because it is a rebuff to the prime ministerial campaign. He personally stepped out and campaigned as the man who's going to hang on to the state for the ruling party. And he failed to do so.
Nationally, I think Narendra Modi enjoys pretty good approval ratings, somewhere around 76%, which is higher than just about any other world leader. But it doesn't seem to have worked in this particular state. What else did Congress do to win Karnataka? Because the BJP nationally has been a vote-winning machine for years, hasn't it?
There is a difference between state elections and national elections. The BJP has just about, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi, won comfortable majorities. But in state elections, actually the party has lost power in a lot of states. And Karnataka is significant because it is a prosperous state. It is a developed state. It has health, industry and social indices which are far better than areas where the BJP dominates in North India. They are now effectively out of power in South India.
Is there anything then we can read into this win today in terms of the general elections next year? year.
In the last two general elections, when Prime Minister Narendra Modi won, subsequently after that, states and the national voting was different. The BJP resorts to campaigns which are about national security, international threats, and the Muslim minority. A lot of its rhetoric is about those kind of external and internal threats. So they will play to that again. The other thing the BJP does is they have built in such a large country. They have actually tried to run with the cult of one leader, as opposed to multiple leaderships in different states where people speak different languages. They did that again in Karnataka, and it has failed spectacularly in Karnataka.
Indian journalist Saba Naqvi. Now to the epidemic of fentanyl, the synthetic opioid largely manufactured in Mexico, which is now the biggest cause of death in the under-50s in the United States. A painkiller 50 times more potent than heroin, fentanyl is increasingly being cut into other drugs, meaning that many of those who overdose on it don't even know they've taken it. It takes 2 milligrams to overdose and kills within 3 minutes. Out of more than 100,000 overdose deaths in 2021, two-thirds involved the drug. The area around the US Capitol is one of the hardest hit. The BBC's James Kumarasamy has been out in Washington, D.C. and surrounding areas to hear about the impact that fentanyl is having on teenagers and about a new proposal designed to save young lives.
Tuesday evening football for the DC Blue Bulls, a youth team playing a non-contact version of the sport called flag football, where tackling involves snatching a yellow tag. These 13-year-old boys from a poor African-American neighbourhood know it keeps them away from some of the dangers lurking off the pitch.
Come out here, play some football, have fun with our team. Stay off the streets and stuff like that.
Like, you start to meet and get in a lot of drama.
What kind of drama?
Drugs, guns, weed.
It's out there for real, like.
Or overdose.
It keeps this kid safe.
Listen! Coach Kojo Ma keeps them in line. Listen! He says it's the kind of discipline they're not used to seeing elsewhere.
The only thing example-wise in front of them is bad examples. You got drugs, murder, prostitution.
You talked about drugs. I mean, we hear a lot about fentanyl at the moment. Is that a big problem here?
Fentanyl is definitely a big problem. I haven't heard it much with kids, though, but the way that they're putting it in a lot of these drugs out here and hiding it, disguising it, and just trying to, like, make drugs a little bit more potent or however they're trying to do it, they put it in weed. Kids want to try weed. They get curious. They try it and don't know fentanyl has been laced with it. So then they pass out or they OD.
Watching from the sidelines, a local mother who knows all about fentanyl overdoses.
Jayla was a very bubbly, loving child.
Shaquita McBroom's 17-year-old daughter Jayla died of an overdose 2 years ago. Shaquita is raising awareness of fentanyl, helping to keep her daughter's memory alive.
My daughter was very interested into boxing. That was one of her things she liked to do. And I was like, why do you want to do boxing? Because I have her sister who loves to do hair. And I was like, you sure you don't want to do something more girly-like? And she said, no, Mom, I like to box. So right before my daughter passed, she was able to get some pink boxing gloves and decorate those really cute.
I mean, I can't imagine losing a child, but it must be the hardest thing. How have you dealt with it?
I'm depressed every day. It's not a day that go by that I feel happy. Mother's Day is coming up. I won't be able to celebrate that day with my daughter this weekend. And I still have the last flower that my daughter insisted on getting me that I would never get rid of.
But America's fentanyl epidemic and the trauma it causes aren't confined to poor black neighborhoods. In the large auditorium of Wakefield High School in Arlington County, Virginia, pretty affluent, majority white suburb of Washington, D.C., a group of parents is watching a presentation about the dangers of opioids, dangers brought home to this school when one of its pupils died recently of a fentanyl overdose. Among the speakers, Rachel Tucker, an assistant district attorney.
Fentanyl has exploded in Northern Virginia over the past several years, and we've seen that reflected in even the price of fentanyl at every level of the distribution chain. Several years ago, fentanyl was going for a really high price, and because of the explosion in supply coming from the southern border, it's much lower and much more accessible to people that typically would not have been exposed to it previously.
Are there other ways that you see the situation evolving?
Several years ago, somebody selling 1,000 pills, that was a big deal. Now we're seeing people are selling millions of pills a month. Just the sheer volume is shocking even to those who do this every day.
So it comes in a box like this. There are two doses in every box, and they are individually packaged in the box. You literally just put it into the nostril, spray one time, and you've administered the medication.
In a local library, instructor Emily Sikvalin shows high school students how to administer Narcan, an antidote to fentanyl recently made available across the counter in America. Later this month, these students will be among the first in the country allowed to take Narcan into the classroom. Emily says the benefits are clear.
It's empowering youth to save a life of a friend. It's also fighting stigma. It's sending the message that this medication is really safe and that there is an antidote for overdose, and it's giving kids the ability to respond.
Emily Sikvalin, ending that report by James Kumarasamy in Washington. Researchers who've studied the rings around Saturn say evidence suggests that they're much younger than the planet itself. Their verdict is based on analysis of cosmic dust which has settled on the rings. It was collected by NASA's Cassini mission, which was deliberately crashed into the planet's atmosphere in 2017. Sean Dilley reports.
Saturn's seven orbiting rings are made up of countless chunks of ice and small amounts of rocky matter. The Italian astronomer Galileo Galilei was the first person to see them 413 years ago. This new research, published in the journal Science Advances, describes them as remarkably young. Physicists from the University of Colorado studied how long it took cosmic dust to settle on the ice that makes up the rings. They used this to calculate that they have likely been gathering dust for no more than 400 million years. Saturn itself formed more than 4 billion years ago, but the team says this knowledge doesn't answer how and why the rings formed, and previous NASA research suggests the formation could vanish completely in as little as 100 million years.
Sean Dilley. There's a new hero in Cambodia, a 20-year-old female athlete. Bo Samnang has won the hearts of many people despite coming last in her race during the Southeast Asian Games on Monday. As Andrew Ochieng reports, it was how she ran the race that entranced those who watched.
It's the first time Bo Samnang has been speaking since that gritty performance. The online videos of her running alone in torrential rain in last position have been viewed hundreds of thousands of times. 6 minutes after Vietnam's Nguyen Thi Wan won the 5,000 metres race, a determined Bo crossed the finish line to the applause of the fans still in the stadium. Now, she's been speaking to reporters as she practised at the National Stadium in the Cambodian capital Phnom Penh, where the race was held. She says love for her country was among the reasons she did not give up.
I tried to reach the finish line because I wanted to show people that in life, even though we go a bit slow or fast, we will reach our destination all the same. We should not give up. We should try our best.
She's won admiration from all over the world and is a hero in Cambodia. Everyone in Phnom Penh, it seems, wants a selfie with her. The Prime Minister, Hun Sen, says he is giving her $10,000. When she first started running while at school, she struggled to get support. Bo also suffered with anemia and says she was feeling weak on the day of the big race. Still, she did not give up and doesn't plan to.
This race was an experience for me. In the future, if there's an event in Thailand or other countries, I will try my best for the country, the people and my supporters.
Bo Samnang also plans to enroll in university this year to study IT and law and has already been offered scholarships.
Andrew Ochieng reporting. The northern English city of Liverpool was bedecked in Ukrainian flags on Saturday evening as it hosted the Eurovision Song Contest on behalf of last year's winners, Ukraine. Kyiv couldn't hold the event following the invasion by Russia last year. The singing competition itself was born after the Second World War as an attempt to rebuild relationships in conflict-torn Europe. And this is how the song contest opened on the dynamic visual stage with a very enthusiastic audience.
Yes, welcome to the grand final of the Eurovision Song Contest 2023!
It's estimated that the global audience for the contest was around 160 million people. Ukraine's entry, Tvochi, performed Heart of Steel, about troops who led an ultimately unsuccessful resistance against Russian forces at the Azovstal plant in Mariupol. The mayor of the singer's hometown, Ternopil, said that it had been attacked by Russia minutes before they took to the stage. But the winner of the night was Sweden. Here's a bit of their song. And with that, we end this edition of the Global News podcast, but there will be a new one later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Lewis Alsop. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Exploring the events shaping our lives through original documentary storytelling.
We'll hear arguments for Roe against Wade.
The documentary from the BBC World Service is a window onto the wider world.
The security situation in Europe has changed in the last couple of years dramatically.
Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.